Well, this is my first opportunity to speak since the Feast of Tabernacles to all of you. And did anybody go to Orange Beach? We've got two in the back that went to Orange Beach. That's where we went this past year. It was the first year for the church. And I'll tell you what, it was one of my favorite beach feast sites. It's much more quieter, less commercialism, not a lot of hotels. They're mostly condos. You're not going to find a motorcycle group or anything going there because of the layout and everything. It's just a super place. I hope that we continue to get that for the next few years. And those of you who like a beach location, we had absolutely perfect weather there. I know some of it. How many people went to Pigeon Forge? I'm sorry. We had just the opposite. We had sunny and 85 almost every day. It was just outstanding, just beautiful. Absolutely wonderful location. No chain restaurants, all mom-and-pop restaurants that were outstanding food. The only setback that we had is during the feast there was the shrimp festival. You may have heard about. Yeah, it made some of the announcements, and you had to stay away from Gulf Shores, but we were in Orange Beach anyway, so it really didn't matter. But, you know, I know a number of you had an excellent time at the feast as well. I've seen some of the pictures from far-off places where you attended in Ireland and different other places like that. And I know that we all had a good feast, a good time, physically, and I hope spiritually as well. You know, there are pleasant memories for all of us when we go to the Feast of Tabernacles or the Winter Family Weekend that you have just experienced. There's inspirational sermons. There's a lot of activities that are inspirational. But hopefully we didn't come back with just a few new notes in a notebook. So I'm going to ask the question, what did you do with what you learned at the Feast of Tabernacles this year? Have you come back and you put that into practice? You know, I know that the sermons were inspirational because we always hear that. We always hear during the feast announcements from the other feast sites. And they always go like this. Well, welcome from so many brethren at such and such site. We're having a beautiful, inspirational time in the pine trees of the woods. And we've had inspiring sermons. The brethren are happy. And so forth. That's what you always hear. You never hear greetings from Pigeon Forge, where it's raining horribly. And the upper parking lot's a mud hole. And the sermons are, meh. You know, you just don't hear that, do you? So I know that you've all heard inspiring sermons. You won't hear that announced, I doubt. But, you know, wherever you were and whatever the weather, we laugh at those things because the weather's not the important thing. It's what we're doing there. It's what we're attempting to show through our lives, the experiences. But what have you been doing with that understanding, with that knowledge that you've gained? For me, it's 34 years, 33 years, I believe, at the feast. For many of you, much longer, maybe all of your life. What are you doing with that? Have you been putting what you've learned into action? Or do you come back and fall into those same routines? You know, it's easy to do. You come back, you go back to work, and you kind of forget about the feeling that you had when you were at the feast. What you decided that you would accomplish, what you decided that you wanted to do. You know, one of the things that makes the Church of God different than the Catholic Church or the Baptist Church or other Protestant churches is that, quite frankly, the sermons that we hear the teachings that we hear, our services, they have real meaning. They have real meaning, and they produce benefit, a tangible benefit, measurable, observable for all of us. When we have sermons and instructions, we have doctrines explained, it should produce a change. And unfortunately, sometimes it doesn't. And when that happens, the sermons and everything that we do, the Feast of Tabernacles, everything that we participate in, if it doesn't produce the change that's required, is really just foolish sentimentality. Doesn't really do anything. It doesn't really mean anything. Worthless drivel. It's kind of interesting to think about. But if it doesn't produce any fruit, what good is all of that? What good is everything that we do? You know, I remember growing up outside the church. I didn't grow up in the church. I grew up outside the church. My family went to the neighborhood church on the corner. It was a Church of Christ. And we were forced to go each week with my aunt and uncle. They would pull up in front. The kids, me and my sister, would pile up out in there. And my mom, my dad didn't go for some reason. I know the reason, but... And we'd all pile in the Chevy and we'd go off to the corner. And, you know, you'd go there and the congregation would sing a hymn or two. I remember that. The kids would play bells. That was kind of neat, you know, having the kids ding out a song. But, you know, I don't remember anything really of substance that I learned in all the time that I attended that church. I might have said this in a sermonette before when we were talking about maybe Passover or Easter or something, but my most vivid memory of attending this particular church is the adults would go to church. The kids would go downstairs to Sunday school, I suppose to indoctrinate, or maybe the main reason was probably to avoid confusion in the church, I suppose. But it was around Easter time, and the pastor's wife was explaining the death and resurrection of Jesus and how it occurred on Friday evening, and how Sunday morning he rose from the dead, and she read the part about 3 days and three nights, and a kid 12 years old can figure that out. Because I went, wait a minute, and I raised my hand, and I said, that doesn't fit. And she said, well, there's this Maundy Thursday that you have to take into consideration. I have no idea what that is. Oh, he died on Thursday then. Well, no, he died on Friday. Well, it still doesn't fit. Well, anyway, my parents got a phone call that their son was causing trouble in Sunday school. And, you know, that's my most... vivid memory. I think I got swats when I get home for causing trouble in Sunday school just for trying to figure out this 3 days and three nights stuff. And, you know, most of the time, that was one of the rare occurrences when I actually went to Sunday school, because most of the time I would go in the front door, come down the steps and go out the back door and play in the field for 45 minutes until the bells rang, and then you came back in the back door and then you acted like you were there the whole time. So that was my Sunday school experience. But, you know, I didn't benefit at all from attending that church. I don't remember benefiting at all. But, you know, God's church is much different. Much different. The Feast of Tabernacles and other events that we attend should be very inspiring to us. And we should learn and be instructed. We are instructed. We're giving answers, real answers. But unless we take positive action with what we've learned, unless we take to heart what we learned at the Feast of Tabernacles, it's all just foolish sentimentality. It's just something that we do. It's just another vacation. We go to the feast, we lay on the beach. Well, what did we learn? What are we doing with that? You know, maybe it's something that you've done your whole life, 33, 34 years for us. Some of you, second, third, fourth generation Christians now. Maybe you haven't thought about all of that. You know, if all you get is a few pleasant memories of a really nice condo, some really good food, laying on a really nice beach, you took some great notes, you got a new notebook full of notes, and maybe a case of the flu. You know, if that's all that you've got, then what did you get? What was it worth? If it doesn't produce change year after year, it really wasn't worth going to. And you can think of your Feast of Tabernacles that way as well. On the other hand, if we go and we see the change, we're inspired by the sermons, and we're inspired by learning how to live under God's government as well, which is something that we should learn when we're at the Feast of Tabernacles. You know, how God's government works, how to put aside little differences and disagreements and to get along under that government. And if we're inspired by the jobs that we have to do now, but especially if we're inspired by the job that we have that the feast represents in the years to come, then one of the most important aspects is that we don't come back and just forget about it and drop back down into our routine and go on like it never occurred. You know, year after year, we have to make those improvements. We have to step up our game. We need to let the Feast of Tabernacles inspire us, spur us to change in every aspect of our lives. Let's turn over to begin in James 1. In James 1, and I'll begin in verse 22, James 1, 22, it says, "But be doers of the word, and not hearers only, deceiving yourself. For if anyone is a hearer of the word and not a doer, he's like a man observing his natural face in a mirror. For he observes himself, goes away, and immediately forgets what kind of man he was." So if we go to the Feast of Tabernacles and we don't allow it to be a springboard to improving ourselves, the inspiration that we felt there, if we don't act on that, we become hearers only. And then the Feast of Tabernacles can be deceitful to us, if you think about that. I wonder if you thought about that before. You know, the Feast of Tabernacles and all of the holy days and all the services that we have should be inspiring to us. It should be. But those things can be deceitful to us individually. Well, I went. I took notes. Therefore, I'm okay. That's not true. Just warming a seat doesn't make you okay. And I'm not just talking to you. I'm talking to me as well. Because I've fallen into that trap myself over the 35 or so years that I've been associated with the church. You know, all the splits, all the hurts, all the bad feelings, it affects all of us. And maybe some of us have stalemated a little bit, but you don't need to stay that way. And if this applies to you, then take heart and make some changes. And recognize that this year, I'm not going to do that again. I'm not going to fall into that same trap. I want to change that one little thing that's been bothering me. I want to work on that. Let's read that same section from the New Living Translation. This is James. I'll start a few verses earlier, James 1:18. It says, "In His goodness we choose to make, in His goodness He chose to make us His own children by giving us the true word. And we, out of all creation, became His choice possession." That's interesting how that's put that way. I wonder if you think of yourself that way, of His choice possession. "My dear brothers and sisters, be quick to listen and slow to speak and slow to get angry. Your anger," in verse 20, "can never make things right in God's sight." Verse 21, "So get rid of all the filth and evil in your lives and humbly accept the message God has planted in your hearts, for it's strong enough to save your souls. And remember, it's a message to obey, not just listen to. If you don't obey, you're only fooling yourself. You're only deceiving yourself. It can be deceitful." Verse 23, "For if you just listen and you don't obey, it's like looking at your face in a mirror but doing nothing to improve your appearance. You see yourself, you walk away, and you forget what you look like. But if you keep looking steadily into the God's perfect law, the law that sets you free, and if you do what it says, and you don't forget what you've heard, then God will bless you for doing it. If you claim to be religious, but you don't control your tongue, you're just fooling yourself. Your religion is worthless." And in verse 27, "Pure and lasting religion in the sight of God, our Father, means that we care for the orphans and widows in their trouble. And what? And we refuse to let the world corrupt us." So just attending the Feast of Tabernacles, regular Sabbath services, doesn't do us any good. It's a start, but we need to act on that. Let's turn over to Ezekiel 33. Ezekiel 33. In verse 31, I'll just read two verses here. "So they come to you as the people do. They sit before you as my people, and they hear your words, but they do not do them. For with their mouth they show much love, but their hearts pursue their own gain. Indeed, you are to them as a very lovely song of one who has a pleasant voice and can play well on an instrument, for they hear your words, but they do not do them." You know, they attended services too. Now, I tend to use the New Living Translation quite a bit after checking to make sure that the meaning hasn't been changed. Some of the modern translations miss the mark occasionally, but I want to read those verses from there. This is verse 31 again. Ezekiel 33, verse 31 from the New Living Translation. "So they come pretending to be sincere and sit before you listening, but they have no intention of doing what I tell them. They express love with their mouths, but with their heart they seek only after money." So there's a physical change, a physical change. They pretend to observe things. But when you get right down to it, the most important thing, there's an element that's missing. There's just something that's not there with these folks. Verse 32, "You're very entertaining to them, like someone who sings songs." So we come back, not we, they come back from the feast and they say, "Oh, we had such inspiring sermons. We had great physical weather. We had wonderful condos. I've got a whole notebook now full of notes and so forth. What interesting speakers we had." Verse 32, "You're very entertaining to them, like someone who sings love songs with beautiful voice or plays fine music on an instrument. They hear what you say, but they don't do it. But when these terrible things happen to them, as they certainly will, then they'll know that a prophet has been among them." And you don't want to be one of those hearers. You don't want to be one of those. And, you know, quite frankly, we still have hearers among us. You know, I remember Mr. Armstrong way back in the 80s, he would say, he would pound the lectern and he'd say, 50% of you don't get this. Well, Mr. Armstrong was wrong. It's more like 80%, wasn't it? How many are left? How many are left? So we don't want to be one of those hearers only. We want to learn and grow and go on. Now, I want to go over a section of Scripture today that it's a story of the Feast of Tabernacles that we're all familiar with. But it was really, really pleasing to God. And the details of that Feast of Tabernacles is back in Nehemiah. If you want to start turning back there, I'm going to go through a little section there. And I know we went through this, Mr. Evans did anyway, in Knoxville, so I assume that he did also here. But he went through the first part of this, but I want to take a look at, you know, not just the fact that they discovered and kept this Feast of Tabernacles with great joy, but I want to take a look at what happened. What was the outcome of that feast? So let's go back there. And in chapter 8, I want to pick up the story. This is Nehemiah 8, and I want to begin reading in verse 8, where it says, they read from the book of the law and clearly explained the meaning of what was being read, helping the people understand each passage. It sounds familiar. That's what we do today at services. Sounds really familiar to what we do. And we see, as we read along, we see in verse 14, they discovered the instructions about keeping the feast, and they kept it with great joy, it says. And picking up the story in verse 18, it says, also day by day, from the first day until the last day, he read from the book of law, and they kept the feast 7 days, and on the eighth day there was a sacred assembly according to the prescribed manner. Well, it sounds an awful lot like what we do today with the Feast of Tabernacles. We go every day. And a little interesting side note here, you know, some might ask, you know, why do we go to services every day? We're only commanded on the first day and on the eighth day. And I've even heard over the years some folks would say, well, I'm not going during the feast. We're only supposed to go the first day and the eighth day. Well, that's a pretty bold statement, I guess. But, you know, why do you go to the feast? Are you going there for a vacation? What's the purpose of the feast? You know, here is an example of one of the very few recorded examples of a feast that really pleased God. And what does it say that they did every day? If you look at the New Living Translation for that verse, in verse 18, Ezra read from the book of the law on each of the 7 days of the festival. Well, who was he reading to if they were all on the beach? He was reading to someone. Then on the last day, and it's kind of interesting, in the New Living Translation it says, on October 15th. That's kind of interesting, I find, because at least, I don't know if it's October 15th that particular year, but it's in the right ballpark. But anyway, on the last day, it says, they held a solemn assembly as the law of Moses required. So they kept the feast for 7 days. And they learned during that feast. They learned a great deal. And, you know, as we all know, the Jewish people kept the feast for hundreds and hundreds of years. This one is one of the few that God records as pleasing him. It was special. And it was special because of the results that it obtained. They heard. They were inspired. And they kept the feast. They were happy. They understood as these things were being taught. But the really important thing about this particular feast is what happened afterwards. Chapter 9. Chapter 9 and in verse 1. Now on the 24th day of the month, the children of Israel were assembled with fasting and sackcloth and dust on their heads. Apparently, because of some of the things they've learned. They just learned during this feast. Then those of Israelitish lineage separated themselves from the foreigners, and they stood and confessed their sins and the iniquities of their fathers. And they stood up in their place and read from the book of the law of their Lord, their God, for 1/4 of the day, and for another 1/4 they confessed and worshipped the Lord their God. So 1/4 of the day, perhaps a 12-hour day. So that would mean that they read for 3 hours. And another part of the day they spent considering those things, what was learned, how they were going to implement those things. But what was the outcome? What was the outcome? Let's continue. Verse 36. And after all this, they said, "Here we are, servants today." They were servants in that land. "And the land that you gave to our fathers to eat its fruit and bounty, here we are servants in it. And it yields much increase to the kings you've sent over us because of our sins. Also, they have dominion over our bodies and our cattle at their pleasure. And we're in great distress. And because of all this, we make a sure covenant and write it down. Our leaders, our Levites, and our priests will seal it." So they decided they were going to make a few changes here. They came to a conclusion. Because of the things they've heard, because of the things they've read, they were convicted. And they were going to write a few things down so they didn't lose it. What did they write down? What did they seal? Let's take a look. You continue in chapter 10. The first number of verses there talk about the people that sealed this agreement, approved this agreement. But if we pick it up in verse 28, we see what they agreed to. "Now the rest of the people, the priests, the Levites, the gatekeepers, the singers, the Nethinim, and all those who had separated themselves from the people of the land to the law of their God, their wives, their sons, their daughters, everyone who had knowledge and understanding." That's interesting the way that's put. "These joined with their brethren, their nobles, and entered into a curse and an oath to walk in God's law." What's that mean? How can you enter into a curse and an oath? Well, the New Living Translation has this verse 29. "Now they all heartily bound themselves with an oath and vowed to accept the curse of God if they failed to obey the law of God as issued by his servant Moses." So that explains a little bit about how you can do a curse and an oath at the same time. But going on in verse 29, "And to observe and do all the commandments of the Lord our God, our Lord, and his ordinances and his statutes." And this is what happened when the feast was over. This is some of the things they put in writing. In verse 30, "We would not give our daughters as wives to the people of the land, nor take their daughters for our sons." So no mixed marriages anymore with the people of the land. You know, they've been doing that. They saw the problems that occur, the outcome of that, and it's just not wise. It's still not wise. Verse 31, "If the people of the land brought wares or grains to sell on the Sabbath day, they would not buy it from them on the Sabbath, but on a holy day. And they would forego the seventh year produce and the exacting of every debt." In other words, they would keep the land Sabbath. But what we learn here is no doubt they started fudging with the Sabbath over the years. And it got worse and worse. The people would come in. They'd maybe set up their tables. They'd sell food, grain, little trinkets. And they would buy those things. They would do their regular shopping, for example, on the Sabbath. They wrote down, they weren't going to do that anymore. We're not going to do that anymore. Verse 32. "They also made ordinances for themselves to exact from ourselves yearly 1/3 of a shekel for the service of the house of God." This is interesting because this is something that's not covered by any law. This is something new. But they looked at the work of God and what was needed in that day. And after the Feast of Tabernacles, they decided that they were going to help out with the work of God as it was in that day. They instituted something like we used to have, like the old building fund. And they decided they were all going to put some money in that, help out with the work. And so that's what they did. So what did the money go for? That's the next verse, verse 33. Here's what they used the money for. The showbread, for the regular grain offering, for the regular burnt offerings of the Sabbath, the new moons, the set feasts, for the holy things, for sin offerings to make atonement for Israel, and all the work of the house of God. So that's what they used that money for. But it's interesting, at this feast, they wrote down what they wanted to do. You know, they said, we've been lax in this area. We want to change this, this, and this. These are what we want to accomplish. You know, we should take note of that practice. We should do that. I've probably done this. Maybe you have too. Maybe this year. You go to the feast. You sit down and you're listening to a sermon. You reflect on what you've accomplished the past year. And you realize, you know, I haven't really accomplished a whole lot this year. And you get inspired. A particular sermon, maybe a series of sermons, and you're inspired, and you feel different, and you feel the magic of the feast, I guess you would call it. And you think, you know, I've really got to do better. And you come back, and you are convinced that you're going to do better. The only problem with that is, how do you measure do better? Where do you start with do better? How is that accomplished? Do better. And you come home, and you're inspired, you're going to do better, and the days go by, and the days turn to weeks, the weeks turn to months, and pretty soon you've realized that you didn't really accomplish much at all the entire year. So let me ask you, a couple months have passed. What have you accomplished? Don't raise your hand and just think in your head. What have you done? Are you just doing better? Or are you working on something in your life? You know, at least these people back at this feast that God was really pleased with, they wrote things down. They decided what they wanted to accomplish, and they wrote it down. You know, we don't qualify to take part in what the feast represents by just going to the feast. We qualify by that, by what we do mostly the entire rest of the year. You think of the hundreds of feasts that the Jews kept, and how many are recorded in detail like this one? Not many. Not many at all. You know, for those people back then, this feast was outstanding. And you know, this past feast can be outstanding for us too. Not because we've heard more inspiring sermons than any other time. Not because we have a new notebook that's full of writing. And certainly not because we ate a few too many steaks and we're a few more pounds heavier. But you know, whether this is an outstanding feast or, as we always like to say, the best feast ever, really depends on the fruit that it bears in our lives. What did we do with that in the following months? We need to use that as a springboard, as a foundation. And we need to build on that foundation. We need to put the spiritual things first in our lives. And we always say that. But it's a lot harder to do than it is to say. We need that feeling that we were convicted at the feast. You know, conversion is a process. We are taught that all the time. And sometimes we forget that. You don't instantly jump to brilliance when you're baptized. You have to work at it. It takes a lot of work. And there are a lot of physical analogies that you can use for that process. You know, your career path, business and industry, for example, is a good example of that process. You know, if I use my career as an example, graduated high school and realized that I probably should go to college if I like to eat for the rest of my life. So I went to college, earned a degree in electrical engineering, and I came back. My wife was working already. Well, actually, my girlfriend was working already, but we had predetermined we were high school sweethearts, so we were going to get married after we had everything in place. And she was working. She was putting money in a bank account. I couldn't find a job in my career field. And I didn't feel like sitting around and watching her put money in the bank account. So I got a job at a gas station. Now, this was back in the day when the gas station attendant guy was the guy who came out, wiped your windows off, put the air in your tires, you know, actually put the gas in your car. It wasn't the guy who sold cigarettes at the, you know, you walk in and do everything yourself. And then an opening came available at Westinghouse Electric, and I applied for that job, but I didn't get that job. But I kept, now that I had a contact information, it's not like today where you put your resume on the internet and it goes into a black hole that you never hear. I had a phone number. I had a name. And I bugged this guy to death. I called him about every week, and it got to be a contest. I wonder if he's going to call next week. Yeah, he calls next week. And finally the guy said, I'll give you a job. Come in here. Well, Westinghouse Electric, wouldn't they have any electrical engineers? So I went in, and my job was to grind the welds off light fixtures. That's the facility they made light fixtures. And I thought, well, okay, maybe I have to work myself into an engineering, even a technician. I'd take anything in the field. That'd be fine. So I worked 2 hours till the first break, and then I asked my supervisor, can I see the engineering department? What engineering? We make light fixtures. There's no engineering. I said, I quit. So I worked for 2 hours, and they handed me $20 when I went out the door. So that was my Westinghouse Electric. But as it became, a job became available where my wife worked, and she told me about it. It was an electronics technician's job. I applied for it, got the job. So that was my starting job, I would call it, out of college. My job was to repair all the electronic equipment in that manufacturing plant. And that was fine. But a couple of years went by, and I was offered a supervisor's position. The supervisors of the electronics technicians. So now I was moving up. So I graduated to the next position. And the technicians counted on me for input, for job assignments. Several years went by, maybe 3-4 years maybe, and I was offered a management position of the department, manager of industrial engineering. It sounds a lot more glorious than it really was because there was only 300 people there. But, the manager of the department. So I moved on up. I went from the gas station to Westinghouse Electric, grinding welds, to fixing and repairing things, to managing technicians, and then eventually managing the entire department. And how I got to be a safety engineer, well, that's a whole other story. But, you know, it is the same thing when you come into the church. And like I said, we have many second, third, fourth generation Christians here. But when you first become enlightened, it's the same thing. You're very young spiritually. You have to work at it. You have to move up. You begin to study and you learn more and more. That's the way it works. You're like that gas station attendant. Brand new and understanding, but you don't stay that way. You shouldn't stay that way. You should be constantly growing. You come to a real sense of repentance occasion when it's the right time. Then maybe it's time for baptism, and you grow, and you start making contributions to the local area, whatever you do. And you're baptized, and you go on from there. And if you imply yourself, if, much like in your career, you continue towards God's kingdom. You know, you don't get promoted if you don't try, if you don't stand out in your career path. You have to differentiate yourself from every other electronic technician. You have to do that. It's a process, and you have to continue to increase through your journey. You know, in the church, many are satisfied. Many are satisfied with coming to church, being baptized, and maybe that's it. Keeping the holy days and the Sabbaths. But you know, we should go on from just rank disobedience. We should maximize our potential. We need to go past what is strictly required. You not only come to church on Sabbath, but you begin to keep the Sabbath correctly because you discovered, maybe I shouldn't do this. Maybe I need to do this and this. And then you start working on the rest of the week. What are you doing the rest of the week? You use the rest of the week right. You know, being the manager of the department has a whole different set of responsibilities than just being one of the guys, one of the technicians. The success of the department was in my hands. The budget was in my hands. People were looking to me for raises, promotions, work assignments. I became the leader of the department. And likewise, when you progress in understanding, you can become leaders in the church, grow spiritually, and learn by word and deed. Lead by that good example. You know, you don't become some goody-goody syrupy person, but you know what I mean. You reflect what you've learned. You show by your example. You work on yourself continually, and you weed out the things that shouldn't really be there. You know, it's always easier to do the physical than it is the mental and the spiritual. Always easier. Always. Physical obedience is not the ticket to the kingdom of God. It's just not. It's required. And doing what is required, you're still an unprofitable servant. I wonder if you thought about that. That almost doesn't seem fair. I do what I'm required, but I'm still an unprofitable servant. You know, think of your career. If I was that technician that came to work at 8 o'clock and I clocked in at 7:59, I was there, I did my job, I went home, I did what I was required. I was just like every other technician. But instead, you come early. You pick up things that are on the floor. That's not your job. You do this. You do that. You do things that make yourself stand out in your career path. That's how you get promoted. That's how it works. You're doing more than what is required. Then you're profitable to that company. And the same in your spiritual life. God says that if you do just what's required, you're an unprofitable servant. You need to go beyond that. You know, do you do something that you really don't want to do and it's a habit? You're trying to change that thing. You're trying to work on yourself. But you do it, and you feel bad, you feel miserable, and you repent. But you do it again. And you feel bad, and you repent. And you do it again and again. Write that one down. That's the one you want to focus on. That's the one you want to change. Make that your goal this year. I am going to fix that one thing where I keep messing up. That's the one I'm going to fix. And maybe there are three or four of those things. Maybe you put off two or three things till next year. We'll work on that next year. But this one, I'm going to fix this year. I'm going to make progress in this area. So what I'm saying is, if the feast inspired you, don't let that feeling go. Don't drift back into your old habits and just simply say that you're going to do better, because rarely that accomplishes anything. You really need to make the Feast of Tabernacles a springboard, and this weekend a springboard of the things that you've learned. Way more than a nice swimming pool, a nice condo, a nice beach. You know, there's only so long. I wonder if you've considered that. You probably have. There's only so long that God will let you sit here without testing to see where your heart is. We've seen that. We've seen that testing. Let's turn over to Luke 13 and look at a parable here. Luke 13. I'm going to read this in the New Living Translation, and I want to put it in perspective. What does it mean to us? Luke 13. And in verse 6, it says, Jesus used this illustration. A man, and in this case God, planted a fig tree, you and me, in his garden, the church. And he came again to see if there was any fruit on it, but he was always disappointed. And in verse 7, finally he said to his gardener, Christ, I waited 3 years and there hasn't been a single fig. Cut it down. It's taking up space we can use for something else. Verse 8, the gardener answered and said, give it one more chance. Leave it another year and I'll give it special attention and plenty of fertilizer. And if we get figs next year, fine. If not, you can cut it down. You know, that's a continual process that happens in the church. You can only mark time for so long before you draw some special attention. And you might not want special attention. Might not be very pleasant, that special attention. Because many times, instead of recognizing what's happening when you receive special attention, you bail out. We've seen that time and time again. Go back into the world. But you know, if your heart's right, and you realize that you're being tested, you're being tried, you can come out of that on the other side much stronger than when you went in. You know, we need to come back from the feast and these other weekends where we learn a lot during that period of time. We need to come back energized, ready to get busy, ready to get going. Need to study, meditate on those things. Work those things over in your mind. Review the sermons, review notes, review the seminar notes that many of you just went to. Let's go over to Psalm 19. Psalm 19. Then in verse 7, it says here, the law of the Lord is perfect, converting the soul. You know, and that's in those that have the Spirit and their minds open. Put it into practice. The testimony of the Lord is sure, making wise the simple. And we all were simple, but we shouldn't remain that way. We should become wise in spiritual matters. Verse 8, the statutes of the Lord are right, rejoicing the heart. And it does cause rejoicing, just like in the day back in Nehemiah. The commandment of the Lord is pure, enlightening the eyes. And it allows us to see things that no one else can see. And David goes on to say in verse 9, the fear of the Lord is clean, enduring forever. The judgments of the Lord are true and righteous altogether. More to be desired are they than gold. Yea, than much fine gold, sweeter also than honey in the honeycomb. Moreover, by them your servant is warned, and in keeping them there is great reward. Who can understand his errors? Cleanse me from secret faults. Keep back your servant from all presumptuous sins. Let them not have dominion over me. Then I shall be blameless, and I shall be innocent of great transgression. And that those are transgressions that would cause us to lose salvation. Not that everybody's perfect and never sins. Everyone makes mistakes from time to time. But these verses, they really reflect a post-feast attitude, a way of life, a dedication that God is looking for. Over in Psalm 119, you don't need to turn there, but this is a hymn that I'm familiar with. Actually, it's become one of my favorites over the years. But in Psalm 119, verse 97, he says, oh, how love I thy law. It's my meditation all day. All day. Do we do that? Do we meditate on God's ways all day? Do we think about sermons that we've heard and run those over in our minds? Try to figure out the nuances. Do we do that? Hopefully God's ways are on our mind continually. You know, while you're driving, I have a 45-minute drive to and from work, and I continually, I always leave the radio off, and I continually try to do things like that, to meditate, to think. While you're driving, you're cutting the grass, whatever. What are you thinking of? Are you thinking of the latest football game when Ohio State beat Alabama? And I'm a Buckeye, so I love to see that. But I was kind of amazed by that. But it's not on my mind continually. Turn to 1 Peter 4. 1 Peter 4. I want to read this from the NIV. And you can follow along. 1 Peter 4, and this is what I've been saying the whole sermon, and in verse 17, for it is time for judgment to begin with the family of God. And if it begins with us, what would the outcome be for those who do not obey the gospel of God? And if it's hard for the righteous to be saved, what will become of the ungodly and the sinner? Wow, that's an interesting verse. It's hard for the righteous to be saved. Well, you might ask yourself, what chance do you have? You know, the only way to make sure is to put that extra effort in, like I was talking about with my career. You know, you don't get promoted unless you put that extra effort in. Stand above the crowd. Do all those little extra things. You know, we read in Nehemiah 8, 9, and 10 about the feast that they had back then. And as I said, that was a unique feast recorded, very pleasing to God. very unique feast. And under Ezra and Nehemiah's instructions, you know, and guidance, they decided they were going to straighten out a few things, straighten out their family life, rededicated themselves to certain things that they wrote down. They were going to keep the Sabbath correctly. They were going to go the extra mile. They put it in writing about what they hoped to accomplish. But we didn't read the final outcome. What was the rest of the story? You know, they had a spiritual feast and a very good physical feast as well. But now we see in the rest of the story, a couple of years have passed. And, you know, we remember that they came back to rebuild the walls and such, and they were a carnal people. They didn't have the Spirit of God like we do today, but Nehemiah left for a while. But what did he find when he came back? Let's pick up the story in Nehemiah 13 and see what he found when he returned. In Nehemiah 13, and I'll wrap up the sermon by looking at what happened to them in the long run here. Nehemiah 13 and in verse 6. But during all this, I was not in Jerusalem, for in the 32nd year of Artaxerxes, king of Babylon, I had returned to the king, and in certain days I obtained a leave from the king. Well, you'll see as we go along, it says certain days. It might have been a number of years here by what we witness had occurred. Let's go on. In verse 7, I came to Jerusalem and discovered the evil that Elisha had done for Tobiah in preparing a room for him in the courts of the house of God. And it grieved me bitterly. Therefore, I threw all the household goods of Tobiah out of the room. Verse 11, let's pick it up there. And I contended with the rulers and said, why is the house of God forsaken? And I gathered them together and I set them in their place. That's an understatement. I wonder how he did that. You think of that. And what else happened? You know, the very things they took oaths about. Verse 15. In those days I saw people in Judah treading wine presses on the Sabbath and bringing in sheaves, loading donkeys with wine, grapes, figs, and all kinds of burdens which they brought to Jerusalem on the Sabbath day. And I warned them about the day on which they were selling provisions. The men of Tyre dwelt there also, brought in fish and all kinds of goods, and sold them on the Sabbath to the children of Judah and in Jerusalem. And I contended with the nobles of Judah and said to them, what evil thing is this that you do, by which you profane the Sabbath day? Did not your fathers do this? And did not our God bring all this disaster on us and on the city? Yet you bring added wrath on Israel by profaning the Sabbath. And in verse 9, so it was at the gates of Jerusalem, as it began to be dark before the Sabbath, that I commanded the gates to be shut, and charged that they must not be opened till after the Sabbath. I posted some of my servants at the gates that no burdens would be brought in on the Sabbath day. Now the merchants and sellers of all kinds and wares lodged outside Jerusalem once or twice, and I warned them and said to them, why do you spend the night around the wall? If you do so again, I'll lay hands on you. And from that time, they came no more on the Sabbath. And I don't think he was going to anoint them. I think lay hands had a different meaning in this. In verse 23, here's the other thing they said they weren't going to do. And in those days, I saw Jews who had married other women, Vashtod, Ammon, and Moab. Another thing they vowed not to do. And it got so bad that in verse 24, see, this, he must have been gone for a considerable amount of time for this to happen. Half their children spoke the language of Ashdod and could not speak the language of Judah, but spoke according to the language of one of the other people. So I contended with them and cursed them, struck some of them, and pulled out their hair, and made them swear by God, saying, you should not give your daughters as wives to their sons, nor take their daughters for your sons or yourselves. Verse 26, did not Solomon, king of Israel, sin by these things? Yet among many nations there was no king like him, who was beloved of his God. And God made him king over all Israel. Nevertheless, pagan women caused even him to sin. So it's very interesting. They had such an inspiring feast back there, but look what happened to them. They did exactly what they said they weren't going to do. But you know, that doesn't need to happen to you and I. It doesn't need to happen to all of us. If we make this feast a springboard, keep that feeling that we had during the feast, and strive to improve, write those things down that we want to get out of this year, not just do better. Do better doesn't accomplish anything. But set some goals, some things that you want to change. And with God's Spirit, it's possible for us to continue to grow in grace and knowledge and have that feast that we just went through as a springboard for the rest of our years.